Coming up next, another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237.
Welcome to another edition of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, president, Local 237 Teamsters. Once again, very special guest. She's no stranger to Reaching Out, and she's no stranger to New Yorkers, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Thank you for coming back to Reaching Out.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you for having me.
Now, by this time, you don't need any introduction because we all know you. So with that, I'll start with our questions. I know that paid leave is a priority of yours. What is the latest effort to get it done?
Well, I've had an interesting effort moving forward with a senator from Louisiana, Senator Cassidy, who's a Republican. And we've been trying to write a bill to create the first ever national paid leave bill. Now, we know that the United States is the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't have a national paid leave plan. And we know that families, no matter who they are going to need some time off at some time to meet the needs of a new baby, a sick parent, a sick family member, a dying parent. And most workers, like 80% of them, don't have access to paid leave. And it really harms the economy. It really harms their families because they can't meet that need. And it's something that we need to really move forward on. And so Senator Cassidy and I have been meeting regularly, and we are going to propose a bipartisan bill that will hopefully create paid leave for the lowest wage workers nationally through a plan that people can opt in if they want to participate. States can opt in, companies can opt in, and that might be a first step towards a national policy.
Now, Senator Cassidy is a senator from Louisiana, correct?
Yep.
Yeah. We find him to be moderate, not so extreme, pragmatic.
And he's easy to work with. And he shares the values of covering workers so that they can stay in the workplace, but also meet those family needs.
Yeah. And he's also, he's an attorney, right?
He's a doctor. He's a doctor. He really understands from the healthcare perspective how important it is for families and parents to be with new infants and new adopted babies. He knows how important it is, you know, when someone's in their dying month that the loved ones can be around them.
So also, you also have a bill, or your priorities are childcare.
Yes. Yeah, so we're also working on affordable daycare. One of the things that got left off the Democratic negotiation last year was an augmentation of early childhood education and affordable quality childcare. I believe that as part of our economy, we need access. We need access to high quality, affordable daycare for children from one and from, you know, just when they're born on to the time they're in school. We've tried very hard to create a universal kindergarten and a universal pre-K program in New York State, but that's not national. And we don't even have enough slots in our own state for the need. And for those years, 0 to 3, parents want to be working and providing for their families, but they need good early childhood educators to do the jobs. So we need higher pay for the educators. We need more resources for the providers. And we need this to be something that the government helps to pay for, because it's important for the U.S. economy. People can't be working, paying taxes if they don't have access to childcare when their children are young.
Do you see or do you have bipartisan support, or are you talking to somebody on the other side of the aisle?
I am. So I've been working with Katie Britt on some ideas. She's a young mother, and she knows the challenges of working and trying to raise children. And so she can appreciate why this is important. It's one of the reasons why I work so hard to get more women elected to Congress, because these lived experiences inform some of our policy, which makes a difference.
And Katie Britt is the senator from Alabama.
Correct. She's very conservative, but on this issue of childcare, she's really bipartisan.
You know, what I find is we have differences and we have common interests. And if we could work on the common interests, maybe we don't have so many differences. once you start working together. So it's very good. It's amazing that I know where those senators are, because there are 100 senators, so it's not common that somebody would know a senator that's not from their state or area. So those two stick out in my mind.
Yeah.
So with union membership at its lowest level in four decades, and with some disappointments in organizing, such as the recent loss in Arizona, where 56% of the workers voted against joining the United Auto Workers Union, what do you think the labor movement needs to do to reverse this trend?
Well, first of all, we need to take concrete steps to protect workers' rights to organize and push back on these union busting activities in a lot of red states. There's right to work states, which really try to mislead and give misinformation to workers that they will be not provided for if they join a union, that they will be harmed if they join a union. We've seen a lot of efforts across the country to union bust. That's very disturbing. I saw a recent report from the Economic Policy Institute that found that something like 60 million workers want to join a union, but couldn't for a variety of reasons, whether they felt intimidated by their employers or didn't know how to even organize. So in the short term, we need to take steps like increasing funding for the NLRB. We need to protect against unfair labor practices and make sure that workers have access to these fair union elections. And then in the long term, we have to pass the PRO Act, which is the big legislation that we have that allows for organizing rights across the country and really supports working people.
You're listening to Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President of Local 237. Teamsters with me and very special guests come once again, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. How about our president? How do you think he can help with organizing labor in the future?
So one of the things that President Biden has always cared about is working people, and he cares about fair wages. He cares about the right to organize. He cares about making sure workers have the benefits that they've earned. And so he is definitely a proponent of the PRO Act. We, I think, collectively have been working on helping the unions that are organizing and do have really active labor movements to be successful. So I've marched on the UAW picket line. I've marched with Starbucks workers. I've marched with Amazon workers. And all of these union activities in New York State have really been productive, really pushing the ball forward, giving momentum and giving inspiration to other unions and other workers' rights advocacy across the country. And so President Biden has done that. He certainly met with UAW workers and marched with them and stood with them. And I think that shows that he cares about working people.
Okay. Switch gears. We talk about veterans. We're coming up on Memorial Day, and the veterans have two holidays, Memorial Day and Veterans Day. But during your tenure, you have fought many hard battles for veterans' rights. As we come up on Memorial Day to honor our military men and women who made the ultimate sacrifice, what more needs to be done on behalf of all veterans and first responders who keep us safe abroad and at home?
Well, I'm working on a number of things. First of all, with the 9/11 first responders and their families and community members, we're working every few years to get that fully funded so that they get the healthcare they need to survive. And that if they do pass because of these terrible diseases that they got because of exposure on 9/11 and after 9/11, that they can get some compensation. So I keep working on that. Second, similarly, we found that veterans that were exposed to the burn pits in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, were getting the same diseases we were getting after 9/11 because the toxins were similar. The toxins are created by jet fuel, lighting on fire, everything. And that's what the towers were when they fell, and that's what's in these burn pits. And so we just got passed a piece of legislation that gave coverage, healthcare, to 3.5 million veterans who are exposed to these burn pits. So now we have to get the word out to these veterans, who many of whom have been denied in the past, to resubmit their requests for health care so they can get the coverage they've earned. I've also been working on benefits for police officers and firefighters to make sure they have better hours for their daycares, so they actually have more access to childcare. Because sometimes their hours starting at 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. and sometimes they have to work till 8 or 9 or 10 p.m. and there's no daycare that's open those late hours. And they're having a trouble recruiting and retaining personnel because of those hardship hours and the lack of childcare. So we're working on legislation to fully fund that so that they can have more flexibility as well. And the other thing we've been working on is helping our first responders and particularly our public service workers get their loans repaid. Right now, if you've done public service for 10 years, you can get all of your student loans expunged, vitiated. They're fully paid by the federal government. And so we've worked with the nurses, we've worked with the teachers, but this also applies to first responders and veterans. And we want to keep working on that. And then last, we have a new scholarship for service program in the Cyber Academy. So any young people who are smart in math, science, or technology, who want to do public service, they can apply to over 600 schools around the country and get tuition free if they agree to do public service for the federal government in cyber for anywhere between 2 and 5 years. And it's the first augmentation of the GI Bill. It's a huge opportunity and most kids don't know about it. So we're gonna try to tell all the high schools in New York. I'm trying to get my colleagues to do promotions in their states. We have 1,000 slots a year. This year, only 700 kids applied and only 150 slots were taken. So we need thousands of kids applying so that all 1,000 slots are taken every year. And it includes New York City schools like Fordham, NYU, City College. What was the other one? Another New York City school. Oh, St. John's. Yep. So it's exciting. It's really a huge opportunity. And then lots of upstate schools like SUNY Albany and Syracuse and Rochester, University of Buffalo, elite schools around the country, schools like Dartmouth, schools like HVCC, Hudson Valley Community College, and what's WCC? Westchester Community College, so all ranges. So we think it's a great chance for more women, more communities of color, more foreign language speakers to get access to a high quality education for free in exchange for that public service.
So tell us, I mean, this is interesting. It's the first time I've heard about this program. How would we advertise it? How would we get more colleges, more students to understand exactly what the program is and how they qualify? Because it sounds like if you have 1,000 slots, 150 people apply at this juncture, if you apply and you really want it, it seems like it's a guarantee for you.
You're going to get it. Well, 700 applied and 150 got it. So it's still a process. But right. You go to my Senate website, gillibrand.senate.gov/cyberacademy. And then it links you to the DOD site that has the application.
Okay. Sounds very good.
Yeah. So, and we're also going to host some Service Academy nights across the state where we'll advertise it. So kids who are interested in service academies, we're going to suggest they also apply to the Cyber Academy because it's still a tuition-free program for public service that if they don't get into West Point or the Naval Academy or the Air Force Academy, they could maybe get into any of these other great schools and still get free college in exchange for service.
That's a tremendous program. And the service that you have to provide is, once again,
You just do the years of which education you get. So you can go work in the CIA, the NSA, the Space Force, any part of the Department of Defense that's non-military that does cyber. Just you become a cyber defender or a cyber warrior. And so you do use your cyber skills to protect the country.
All right. It sounds interesting. Yeah. Sounds very good. Let's talk about women's rights. I know you can talk about that back and forth. Right now, where are we with women's rights? I mean, I just heard today that I believe it's Louisiana. Is it Louisiana that's making abortion pills, the abortion pill illegal?
Probably. I mean, yeah. There's been an all-out assault on women's rights across the country post the Dobbs Supreme Court decision. And that decision said that women do not have a right to privacy and do not have a right to access to reproductive services, including abortion, if their state outlaws it. So these red states are denying women the right to travel across state lines to get abortion services. They're denying them the right to get medicine in the mail. They're denying them the right to have private conversations on social media with their parents. They denied a couple who was trying to take their 10-year-old across state lines to get an abortion because she was raped. It's really terrible. And so women's rights are under attack. We are second-class citizens. And former President Trump has vowed that he will try to make a national 15-week ban, which is very destructive. And so we are fighting back. We fight back with ballot initiatives. There's been ballot initiatives in lots of red states already that have won. So when they try to deny reproductive rights, we overturn them. When they try to give reproductive rights, they succeed. So we've won in places like Montana and Kentucky and Kansas. We hopefully will have a ballot initiative in New York State for equality for everyone. It's in the courts right now, so we'll see if that prevails. There's other states that are vying to have the same thing, to have ballot initiatives. There's about 9 states that are looking at it that are either in the courts or on appeal or getting signatures to have ballot initiatives. So the more the merrier. There's going to be one in Florida. There's going to be one in Maryland. And then there's a bunch of other states that are trying to get it. So that's a way we can restore our reproductive rights. And I'm also fighting to make the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, our next constitutional amendment. It's gone through all the Article 5 requirements. It's been passed by the House and Senate by 2/3 majority in the 1970s. It has been ratified by 3/4 of the state, with Virginia being the 38th state in 2020. And the only reason it's not the 28th Amendment is because Trump was president and he had his Office of Legal Counsel write a memo saying it took too long to become a constitutional amendment based on one Supreme Court case from 1921. That said all constitutional amendments needed to be timely in how long it takes from the day they're proposed. Well, that's not true, because since 1921, we had the 27th Amendment become law, and that took 203 years to become a constitutional amendment. We also have precedent to say you can't set a timeline. So the 7-year timeline in the first version of the Equal Rights Amendment isn't operative constitutionally. And then you have another argument saying, well, if you do think Congress can set a timeline, you at least have to put it in the actual text of the amendment. This 7-year was mentioned in the preamble. And most contract lawyers know preambles, prefatory language is all just context. It's not operative when it comes to a constitutional amendment. So these are our arguments. We're asking the archivist to sign and publish. If she does, then I believe we could take that right and overturn the Dobbs decision writ large, but certainly how it's being applied in these red states. It's not equal if women of reproductive years don't have a right to privacy, but men do. It's not equal if women can't travel across state lines, but men can. It's not equal if women can't have privacy in the mail, but men can. So I think you could apply an equal rights amendment to guarantee reproductive freedom in this country if we had it as part of the Constitution. So I'm working on convincing the archivist this is the right move. And I've prepared legislation, I've prepared briefs, and I'm just really trying to advocate to her that she has the authority to sign and publish all by herself. She doesn't need anything else. She doesn't need a new OLC memo. She doesn't need anyone's permission. It's her job, once the two things are done, to sign and publish.
Wow, you know, that's a lot. I never thought we would be here.
No, you never imagined. But even Samuel Alito said in his decision that there is no protection for women in the Constitution. And so we need to put it in there so that we have protection.
Well, if there was protection in the Constitution for women, it still wouldn't change his opinion, because it sounds like he just wants to make decisions for women. And, you know,
he does.
Yeah, I mean,
but I think he'd have a tougher time if we had an equal rights amendment, because it's been used in states already to say you can't abrogate their right to reproductive care.
Yeah, it's just a shame. It's just, I never thought that a group of men helped by some women, would want to control people. I mean, I never thought I would grow up and this would happen in my lifetime. I never thought this would happen. Couldn't imagine this would happen. Something that was already done. And I watched all of the hearings for the Supreme Court, and to a person, they said that the abortion was settled law.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes to show you, people just lie to you. You should also put in the law that anybody who goes before the Senate for Supreme Court confirmation and they give their opinion and word, they can't go back on it. Whatever they say to get the job, they should have, it should be settled, because you, meaning you and the Senate, are voting on the assumption that during the interview, the candidate gave their word on however they would govern, whatever that is, whether you liked it or not, they gave their word and you knew what you were getting.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know of any other job that you could go for that you would lie on your application.
Yeah, and still get the job and then get to keep the job for the rest of your life.
That's right. And even for anything that's settled for the rest of your life. Yeah, there should be caveats on that. So is there any movement to, I would say, put in, what's the word I want to use? Something for the Supreme Court justices. Something.
Yes. So I have an idea. Yeah. Yes. How about term limits for the Supreme Court justices? If you said you could only serve for 20 years, then you could get rid of some of the stubborn ones who keep really creating trouble. And then you'd only have 20 years of anybody who is radically ridiculous. So it would be good to be able to have a limit on these Supreme Court justices. And I think that could depoliticize the court.
Yeah, and term limits. And also there should be, I would say that they couldn't take gifts. So what's the word I'm looking for?
Yeah, they need an ethics reform.
Ethics reform.
We have a gift rule. You can't take gifts in the Senate. You have to disclose anything, any gift that's over $300. They should be obligated to follow all the ethics rules that the U.S. Senate is under. It's obscene that they can take lavish vacations from people with business before the court. They're not immune from being compromised. They're human. Not having ethics rules that apply to them, that apply to everyone else, is, in my opinion, an outrage.
So how could we get that going? How would that work?
There's a couple bills already written. Yes. Sheldon Whitehouse has really led this issue, and we would need the majority in the House and Senate to get a vote on it. Majority of the House, which I'm trying to do through my majority fund, my New York majority fund. I'm trying to create a coordinated campaign to flip the House. Since we lost 5 seats last cycle, I think we can win them back. They're all Democratic seats. We have good candidates. And if you flip the House and still have a majority in the Senate, the current 50 senators that are running that are Democrats would abridge the filibuster. So you could, with a 51 vote majority, change the ethics rules for the Supreme Court easily.
Now, I think you can get that done. Would you need the president to sign off on that also?
Well, no, he'd have to make sure he didn't want to veto it. If he wanted to veto it, then you'd have to override the veto. It'd be very hard to get two-thirds of the Senate to override a veto.
Okay, that's desperately needed. That should be bipartisan.
Yeah.
Yeah, that should be bipartisan.
I think it will be. I'm gonna work on that for the next Congress.
Good. So are there any other things you wanted to say to our listeners and viewers before we sign?
I would just say, please don't forget to vote. Our vote is our voice. Our vote is our democracy. And when we don't value our vote, we don't value our democracy. And we need to fight for it. It's under attack all across the country.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President of Local 237. Very special guest, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. Thank you very much for coming back.
I appreciate you.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to tune in again each and every Saturday at this same time for another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, President of Teamsters Local 237.